Leviticus chapter 17 and 18 is what we'll look at this evening. We just finished the Day of Atonement. Remember last time how God forgives sin. And now we get back to the more common parts of God's law. Just a series of laws that we're going to look at as we're rather accustomed to. What we're going to find, though, or what I think you should look out for as we read these laws, is not only the details of the laws, but try and find the point in the laws, maybe a verse or even a paragraph, sometimes in the beginning, sometimes in the middle somewhere, sometimes at the end, that gives the point of these laws. Because these laws never just come as a string of instructions. There's always a point to every collection of laws. Chapter 17, verse 1. And Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron and his sons and to all the people of Israel, and say to them, This is the thing that Yahweh has commanded. If any one of the house of Israel kills an ox or a lamb or a goat in the camp, or kills it outside the camp, and does not bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting to offer it as a gift to Yahweh in front of the tabernacle of Yahweh, blood guilt shall be imputed to that man. He has shed blood, and that man shall be cut off from among his people. This is to the end that the people of Israel may bring their sacrifices that they sacrifice in open field, that they may bring them to Yahweh, to the priest at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and sacrifice them as sacrifices of peace offerings to Yahweh. And a priest shall throw the blood on the altar of Yahweh at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and burn the fat for a pleasing aroma to Yahweh. So they shall no more sacrifice their sacrifices to goat demons, after whom they whore. This shall be a statute forever for them throughout their generations." Interesting set of laws. At first you think it's just every time you kill an animal to make food, and you realize, no, this is all about sacrifices. And so when it talks about if anyone kills an ox, a lamb, or a goat in the camp or outside the camp and doesn't bring it to a tent of meeting, then there's a big problem. Well, it's only if you do it for the sake of sacrifice you find it. That's the context here. Laws about blood being shed. That's more the term than simply killing a lamb or a goat or an ox as an offering, right? It's talking about blood being shed. What is the point verse in this collection of laws? Well, it's verse 5, right? To this end, that the people of Israel may bring their sacrifices that they sacrifice in open field, that they may bring them, repetition there, that they may bring them to Yahweh, to the priest at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and sacrifice them as sacrifices of peace offerings to Yahweh. Here's the point. This is not a sin or a guilt offering. This is a peace offering. And so, what is a peace offering? A peace offering is an offering you would bring simply to rejoice in the fact that you are at peace with God because of the great Day of Atonement. Because it's very natural that these laws are given immediately after the great Day of Atonement. You've made peace with God for the whole nation, the priest says. And now you go home and you're so overwhelmed by the fact that the God of heaven and earth is dwelling in your midst in a peaceful relationship with sinners. And so you want to worship God for that. And so you do a sacrifice, a peace offering. And a big point here is you can do that wherever you do it, but you have to then actually bring the animal to the tent of meeting. Why? Because blood is being shed. That's kind of a big point in this chapter, the rest of the laws. Blood is being shed, and you need a priest, and it must be before the Lord. Very simple here. You may worship the Lord wherever you go. You must. But remember, you still need a priest in God's presence when you shed blood. When you take an animal, and you take its life as a substitute for your own life in any form of worship, sacrifice, it must be done with a priest in front of God. Very, very important sacrifice. It must be a gift to Yahweh in front of the tabernacle of Yahweh, the previous verses. It must be with a priest present. You are not your own priest, in other words. You can worship wherever you want, but you can't worship however you want. You are not your own priest. You need a priest. And that's still true for us, right? We can worship wherever we want. But we do need to still go through a priest. It has to be through Christ, our priest. It cannot be through any other way. And that's why he makes that point at the end, not sacrificing their sacrifices to goat demons. Okay, there's clearly a practice of sacrifices in the open field, wherever you are in your home, in your field, wherever, vineyard. And they would sacrifice a goat specifically as a Canaanite practice, perhaps, that they're going to come across. Or maybe this is something that they did in Egypt. And Moses says, we worship differently. Oh, we can sacrifice anywhere, but it must be brought to the priest at the tabernacle. Worshipping God is not something you do just because you like doing it and you think it is appropriate. You need to worship God through a priest, through Christ. We get to verse 8 then, a new set of laws. Well, just kind of a two verses here, a short section. And you shall say to them, any one of those of Israel or of the strangers who sojourn among them who offers a burnt offering or a sacrifice and does not bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting to offer it to Yahweh, that man shall be cut off from his people. Now we know what cut off means. It's that scapegoat that goes out with all the sins and dies under God's hand. Year 2. Every one of the house of Israel and those who sojourn, so those who are not just traveling through, but those who have come to join them, even though they're not of the house of Israel, which is actually a fair part of the company around Mount Sinai, because remember, many Egyptians actually joined them in the Exodus. It doesn't matter if you're among God's people and God is in your midst, and you want to worship God, in this case, burnt offering or sacrifice of any kind, you have to bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting. Later in Deuteronomy, a big theme will be you will worship the Lord where He chooses for His name to dwell. Talking about how the moving tabernacle with Him will one day be a fixed place. You have to go to the right place. Now remember, Jesus makes a big deal of this with the Samaritan woman and says it's coming a time where you can worship anywhere. The place is not anymore going to be important. But for the nation of Israel, moving to the promised land, and then in the promised land, you go to the right place to worship God. You don't just do it whichever way you want in the comfort of your own convenience. Then verse 10, different set of laws, but now it talks very specifically about the shedding of blood, taking the blood of an animal as a substitute for your own. If any one of the house of Israel or of the strangers who sojourn among them eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood and will cut him off from among his people. For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it for you on the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is the blood that makes atonement by the life. Therefore I have said to the people of Israel, no person among you shall eat blood, neither shall any stranger who sojourns among you eat blood. And any also of the people of Israel or of the strangers who sojourn among them, who takes in hunting any beast or bird that might be eaten, shall pour out its blood and cover it with earth. For the life of every creature is in its blood. Its blood is its life. Therefore, I have said that to the people of Israel, you shall not eat the blood of any creature, for the life of every creature is its blood. Whoever eats it shall be cut off. And every person who eats what dies of itself or what is torn by beasts, whether he is a native or a sojourner, shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the evening. Then he shall be clean. But if he does not wash them or bathe his flesh, he shall bear his iniquity. Oh, lots of things going on here. What's the point verse again that explains the significance of this rather strange law that literally has no particular bearing to anything except just God said so? Sorry? Verse 11 and verse 14. It's actually somewhat repetitive, this section, isn't it? Verse 11, for, why this law about not eating blood? For the life of the flesh is in the blood. Very simple. Blood, any living creature's blood is a direct one-to-one representation of its very life. With its blood, it lives and provides life to the whole body. Without its blood, it's dead. More so than breath or any other thing, God says, when you think of an animal's blood, or your own blood for that matter, think that is the life of the animal. And so, the life of the flesh is in the blood. And I have given it for you on the altar to make atonement for your sin. By now we know the priest does a lot of things with the blood of the sacrifices. It gets sprinkled here, it gets sprinkled there, it gets dipped there, it gets put there, everything. The blood is very significant in sacrifice. Now you understand why. Okay, we learned lots of things about sacrifices, but the blood was never actually explained to us. Now, after the Great Day of Atonement, you have to realize the full significance of the blood. A life was given for your soul. Instead of your soul bearing its own condemnation, another soul, another life was given. Obviously, animals don't have souls, it's just life. But you get the point here. God gave us animal blood for atonement. That's why animals have blood. And that's why when you kill an animal as a sacrifice, you do special things with the blood to make atonement for your sin. And so, all of Israel was going to have a super, super strict set of rules on what you do with animal blood. You, number one, do not eat it. It's not given for you for food, like the flesh is. It's given to you for atonement. It doesn't go into you for your use and your purposes, be it cultic or whatever, dietary, if you want to do that. You specifically use it only to accomplish spiritual atonement. Well, the blood does nothing, but the substitute does, doesn't it? You have to go back. The life is in the flesh of the blood, and God has given it to them on the altar to make atonement for your soul. For, the verse continues, it is the blood that makes atonement by the life. Okay, so it's not actually the blood itself. The blood makes atonement because it is the physical, fleshly symbol, representation of this animal whose life was given. All life is God's life. God owns all life. Your life, an animal's life, everybody's life. So if you take a life, it's called shedding blood. If you take a life, there's all kinds of divine things you have to give an account for. And so, if a man takes a man's life, by man that life taker, the blood shedder's life will be taken. Okay, so you have to report directly to God if you murdered somebody. And God says you need to be killed for that. So God gives instruction to another man to take your life. Because all life is God's life. Same with animals. All animals' life belongs to God, not you. It might be your sheep and your goat and your turtle dove. It might be the corpse you came across the roadkill and you took some of it home to eat. You see that law later, right? But it belongs to God. If there's blood in it, the life belongs to God. You must give an account to God for every time you do something with the blood of an animal, or a man for that matter, in murder. Verse 14, you again see, for the life of every creature is its blood. Its blood is its life. Direct correlation here. Okay, when you think blood, think life. When you think life, then think, hey, the physical blood. Therefore I have said to the people of Israel, you shall not eat the blood of any creature, for the life of every creature is its blood. Whoever eats it shall be cut off. You are in direct opposition to God if you take the life of something without the parameters that God set for it. It's kind of serious, isn't it? By the way, of all the Old Testament laws that are still true in the New Testament too, that are timeless, this is one of them. Acts chapter 15. Church comes together, all the apostles get together, a few others as well, all the leaders. James, for example, is there. Not James the apostle, he's also there, but James, the church leader in Jerusalem, the brother of Jesus. And they have a big meeting with all the apostles to be like, Jews are keeping all these laws, Gentiles are not. They're actually literally, especially with blood. Okay, every pagan culture does something with the blood that is highly offensive to God. And so, like, what do we do? Which Old Testament laws, none of them are necessary anymore, but the Jews keep them and the Gentiles don't. Which ones should the Gentiles still keep? And this is one of them. Because all life belongs to God still. It's not that Christ became the once-for-all priest and sacrifice, so we don't need priests and sacrifices in that sense anymore. We have a better priest, a better sacrifice. We still need one, but we just have a better one. This, there's still life in the blood. And if you take a life from anything, you must give an account for it. And so you can kill an animal, and you can let its blood go into the earth. That's fine. You see that later, right? And you can eat the animal. That's fine. But you can't eat it with the blood. And if you come across something that died of its own, so it didn't bleed out, for anybody who's ever butchered animals, you know, if you don't let it bleed out immediately, then the blood kind of stays in. It doesn't come out later. And so if you eat that, then you need to go home and realize what you've done, and you have to wash yourself and you will be clean. It's not that blood is inherently good or bad for you. It's simply that blood was God's business of taking that life. It belonged to God. And when I eat an animal, I may not eat the blood. Now that I did eat the blood because it was still in the meat and everything in the flesh, you have to wash. And if you don't, if you don't wash yourself that night, you will be cut off. Simple little practices, right? Hey, did you wash last night? No, I didn't. Ouch! Out of the camp. It's not just a simple practice when it directly relates to taking life in terms of what God said is not right, because it belongs to Him. Questions or comments on this, the kind of shedding of blood away from the tabernacle and then the shedding of blood in this context? Yes, way at the back. Speak loud.
Why would people want to eat blood?
Great question. Why would people want to eat blood? Well, the superficial answer is things like, well, that's what our culture has always done. Or it's a delicacy in our culture. Or something like that. The real reason it goes back to whenever they did it is because they don't understand that the life and the blood that symbolizes that life belongs to God. And so it's unbelief and resistance to what God has said. That started all these things that now we just call culture or delicacies or whatever. But we need to go back, like they did in Acts 15, and tell people who grew up in those kind of cultures and had those kind of dietary practices, and say, no, you don't understand the significance of life. And every time you don't eat the thing you used to eat because of the delicacy, or every time you don't practice the ritual that you and your family used to practice, you are reminded that life belongs to God. And the blood is the life, and so we treat the blood very, very special. It can go in the ground. When you're hunting, you can let it bleed out. That's literally what hunters do, right? You slit the throat, let it bleed out quickly, and you typically cover it with ground, unless you have a fancy facility where you dispose of it some other way. That's okay. But you cannot drink it, you cannot eat it, you cannot use it for your purposes. Does that help? All right, verse 11 and 14 were the four statements, the point statements there. No life belongs to us. Belongs to the animal, the creature, it belongs to God. Now we get to chapter 18. Very, very different set of laws. It is all about sexual purity. Being naked with someone else, to put it very bluntly, the way the law does. But first, this is where you start with a great statement of preparation, giving you the point of these laws. The point will later come up again. But the first five verses are just totally different to all these other laws. And Yahweh spoke to Moses, chapter 18, verse 1. Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, I am Yahweh your God. Like, I like this law. It's not even a law. It just is. that way. You shall not do as they do in the land of Egypt where you lived. And you shall not do as they do in the land of Canaan to which I am bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes. You shall follow my rules and keep my statutes and walk in them. I am Yahweh your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my rules. If a person does them, he shall live by them. I am Yahweh. What do you think is the point of this section? I am Yahweh. I am the Lord who made a covenant with you. I am your God. You are my people. And so, don't do like the people you came from. Don't do like the people you're soon going to meet. You do whatever I say. Why? Because I am Yahweh. This is a significant point in the law of Moses, given to them by God. These laws are not given because they're good for you primarily, even though at the end it says you will live by them, right? These dietary laws on what you may eat and may not eat, these sacrifice laws, these all kinds of different cleanliness laws and sickness laws are not primarily given for your benefits. They're primarily given because that's what God does. He gives laws that are so good. Just rights. Not good for you, per se, but just good. It is the good thing to do. It gives a sense of Godward focus in all that we as Christians do in our lives. Be careful of saying, I need to keep God's laws because it will be good for my marriage. And I shouldn't break God's laws because it will be good for my parents' thing. I should keep God's laws because my kids will benefit from it. I should keep God's laws because it will go well with me. All those things that are true, but that's not the main point of God giving laws or of us keeping and knowing those laws. The main reason why we even care to read Leviticus is because God said Leviticus. God spoke these words. That makes them important. I've often said, in your Bible reading, especially your routine reading, not your specific study prep, but your routine reading, don't look for something to read that's useful for the day. Read whatever is next because God said it, and so it must be useful for the day. You see where you start. God said it. And I want to know everything that God ever said. The big point here, obviously, is that when it comes to obeying God's laws, you get relationship with God. You get covenant before you get commandments. I hate using the word relationship because then you get that whole, Christianity is about relationship, not religion, and that's just false. All of these things are religious laws. But I like the word covenant and commandments. In God's economy, He first delivers you, then He tells you how to live. And yes, His instructions on how to live is available to unbelievers too, but they won't understand that and they won't live by it if they first enter into covenant with God. And you really had a hint of that happening because up to now, a few times we were very explicitly told, this is the rule for the house of Israel and this is the rule for the stranger who has decided to live with you. Who has come into covenant from outside with God. Not through God's selection of Abraham, but outside entrance. This is their laws too. And then the simple point is, and you can apply this right to worldliness in general, you will not do like Egypt, you will not do like Canaan, you will do like me. You will keep my statutes. Will follow my rules and keep my statutes and walk in them because I am the Lord your God. So very practically we can say for living, evangelism, whatever you want to do, who is your God? Live that way. Who is your God? Go live that way. And may your God be the Lord God of heaven and earth. Then we get to these laws. None of you shall approach any one of his close relatives to uncover nakedness. I am Yahweh. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father, which is the nakedness of your mother. She is your mother. You shall not uncover her nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's wife. So that's if it's your, like, a stepmother, if your father got married again. It is your father's nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your sister, your father's daughter, or your mother's daughter, so it's even stepsisters, whether brought up in a family or in another home. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your son's daughter or of your daughter's daughter, for their nakedness is your own nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's wife's daughter brought up in your father's family, since she is your sister. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's sister, she is your father's relative. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your mother's sister, for she is your mother's relative. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's brother, that is, you shall not approach his wife, she is your aunt. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your daughter-in-law, she is your son's wife, you shall not uncover her nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your brother's wife, it is your brother's nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of a woman and of her daughter, and you shall not take her son's daughter or her daughter's daughter to uncover her nakedness. They are relatives, it is depravity. You shall not take a woman as a rival wife to her sister, uncovering her nakedness while her sister is still alive. Kind of an odd little situation there. Don't go and marry and have sexual relations with your wife's sister while your wife is still alive. What is the point of these? It's both enlightening and a bit surprising. Because it says you cannot uncover the nakedness of any of all these people. And half of them, that you would think the main reason is because that's adultery. Because it's sexual immorality. But the only reason that's ever given is because it's a relative. Now, this is very significant, actually. Number one, it protects the sexual purity of family and relatives where there is most likely temptation and opportunity to actually uncover someone's nakedness and commit sexual immorality. And we know that, right? Most sexual abuse cases are in terms of close relatives. And so you can understand the practical wisdom of this. But this is also significant because up to now, it wasn't wrong to marry a relative. Okay, Abraham and Sarah, we looked at it this morning. Half sisters, so that's your mother's daughter, your father's daughter, I don't know which way around it was. From another wife or another father then, obviously, mother or father. Yeah, it's all relatives. And so here God puts an end to relatives marrying each other and having sexual relations. Puts an end to that. No more may you get married and uncover the nakedness of your relative. Not through marriage or not through sexual morality, obviously, either. Simply because it's relatives. Medically, people have actually discovered there's medical value to this. Because as we, contrary to evolutionary theory, as we're genetically degenerating, devolving, you get all kinds of odd things happening in birth defect when you have close relatives with the same genetic flaws getting married and having kids. But that's not the point here. It is simply because two reasons were given, right, for these laws. I am Yahweh, verse 6, which is kind of the tone of the previous five verses, and verse 17, it is depravity. God says this is a depraved way, a sinful nature kind of way that's completely engrossed in its own sin. And so that's why, for the most part, it's probably talking about sexual morality here and not through marriage specifically. But you do see in verse 18, there is a rival wife, so marriage is actually included in this as well, even if it's not the primary focus. What do we learn from this? Because God is God, there exists sexual morality, positively speaking, sexual purity, simply because God exists. God defines what is right and wrong sexually. And so whatever you do with a man and a woman, whatever you do when you don't have your clothes on or when you find somebody who isn't, or you unclothe somebody for whatever reason, God has something to say about that. And so there's a great fear of God comment in the beginning, I am Yahweh, and at the end, recognizing just how bad it is to not recognize sexual purity. Verse 19 continues. You shall not approach a woman to uncover her nakedness while she is in her menstrual uncleanness. And you shall not lie sexually with your neighbor's wife and so make yourself unclean with her. You shall not give any of your children to offer them to Molech and to profane the name of your God. I am Yahweh. You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination. And you shall not lie with any animal and so make yourself unclean with it. Neither shall any woman give herself to an animal to lie with it. It is perversion. Quite a few comments here on sexual perversions again. What are the reasons given? Well, it's uncleanness. I am Yahweh. That one shows up again. It is an abomination. It is a perversion. So these five verses are the more extreme version of the previous paragraph. Previous paragraph is just things that might happen in ordinary sexual morality in a family setting. This is the more extreme version of you're completely given over to sexual morality. Not only are you practicing it in a perverted way in the easy context, you're going inventing new contexts for it. Sounds a little bit like the average society we live in nowadays, isn't it? It is an abomination. It is perversion. But then in the middle of it, you get verse 21. That has nothing to do with sexual morality. Did you notice that? You shall not give any of your children to offer them to Molech and so profane the name of your God. I am Yahweh. What you realize here is if you, because you cannot control yourself sexually, become sexually immoral, that immorality is probably eventually going to lead to sexual perversion of an extreme nature, and it always comes with overt pagan practices. It is an absolute denial of who your God is, the God of heaven and earth, the covenant-making God. And so, all of us, sexual purity is important at the first level because it's a one-way street to complete paganism. There's a reason why in Romans chapter 1, when it talks about homosexuality, for example, okay, which is mentioned here, that it talks about it as a being given over kind of sin. Like it's beyond the normal bounds of society's sins. It's in the next category. And why when you meet people who are enslaved to these kind of sexual perversions, you realize their sexual perversion is the slightest of their problems. They need the gospel. They need to know who the true God is because they are in overt forms of paganism. It's also why when you find overt forms of religions who are so far removed from Christianity over the generations, that they always include a major component of sexual immorality of the worst kinds. That's the New Testament era, right? That the apostles lived in. It was like that, thanks to the Roman religions. All of this, what's the point? Well, verse 1 to 5 is the point. God is the true God. He defines the morality of sexuality. Verse 24. A few different laws here. Do not make yourselves unclean by any of these things, for by all these things the nation I'm driving out before you has become unclean, and the land became unclean, so that I punished its iniquity, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. Very visual here. But you shall keep my statutes and my rules and do none of these abominations, either the native or the stranger who sojourns among you. For the people of the land who were before you did all these abominations, so that the land became unclean. Lest the land vomit you out when you make it unclean, as it vomited out the nations that was before you. For everyone who does any of these abominations, the persons who do them shall be cut off from among their people. So keep my charge, never to practice any of these abominable customs that were practiced before you, and never to make yourself unclean by them. I am Yahweh your God. And he's going to throw that in to realize we're still part of the chapter 1, or verse 1 to 5 section. What's the point here? Well, the point is in verse 24, do not make yourself unclean by any of these things. And the picture that God gives the nation of Israel is very visual, right? People do unclean things. They worship pagan gods and they commit sexual perversions. Because of that, the land, the earth under them, becomes unclean. Talk about our sin affecting creation. That land then eventually gets fed up with uncleanness. Just like your stomach eventually gets fed up with enough nonsense you put down your throat, and it just vomits it all up again, saying, I want none of this, it's out. So the land is going to vomit out the Canaanites when they get to the land of Canaan. It makes you realize, you have a really good answer to people who are like, how could God command his people to massacre entire people groups when they took over the land of, just for a piece of land? You get that argument sometimes from those who think the Old Testament God is this malicious, evil, unfair God. You're like, no. That was just the human agent and the land vomiting out because of a bad day. You don't want to live in among those kind of people. Those are the kind of people that if people don't put an end to them under God's judgment, a direct command obviously, the land itself will make sure they get out, because the land doesn't want people that filthy and that evil and that detestable and that abominable and that perverted on it. The land will vomit them out. And then God says, when you get there, don't do the same things, because you're on the same land. If the land vomited them out for these things, certainly it's going to vomit you out too. So very, very little visual picture here. You can kind of see the little boys on the plains of Moab overlooking the Jordan River and Jericho there, and the hills of where Jerusalem will one day be built, and looking at it and be like, I wonder if those hills ever just go, bleh, and just kind of vomit out all the Canaanites into the Dead Sea or something like that. You're going to see the little boys with a visual picture, right? Having understood these laws. Yeah. Israel's false worship, even in Malachi, okay, in the Old Testament, Malachi is still bemoaning the fact that her worship is false. And that's why they went into exile. Sexual perversions was certainly part of it. Child sacrifice was certainly part of it. So you had that overt pagan practices with the sexual morality that went with it. Obviously, the Sabbath breaking was a separate reason for the exile. They were vomited out of the land. And it's almost as though while the nation of Israel was in exile in Babylon, the land was like, phew, get some rest from all the evil that's going on in here. And to this day, while they might be in the land again, but it's not because of true worship. It's not the end where God restores them yet. Okay, that hasn't happened. And so the land might still vomit them out again because of their unbelief and their perverted practices. The point here, combining these two chapters, and they do go together a little bit, because you have the Great Day of Atonement that immediately starts talking about how you sacrifice, but it starts using the phrase shedding of blood, which then brings you to this whole set of laws about the life being in the blood, and so that whatever you do with the blood is very important to God. And then you transition to this little section of five verses that just gives you a great fear of God again, and then immediately God strikes them while they have that great fear of God with, don't you ever commit sexual immorality. Not even of the most common kinds, certainly not of the perverted kinds, because that is literally why God judges nations. And you are a nation whose God is Yahweh. And so this is where you're going to be profoundly different to those around you. These are great verses to counsel people with sexual morality, right? It's super common. Everybody does it. Egypt did it. Canaan did it. Everybody did it. But the only everybody's who do it are the overt pagans. In God's people, things are dramatically different. Why? Not because they've realized how good it is for our marriage and our family and our kids and our posterity if there's sexual morality, but because they've realized who their God is and have come to fear. Back to verse 5. You will therefore keep my statutes and my rules. If a person does them, it's very positive here, right? Verse 5. If a person does all my rules, he shall live by them. You'll do just fine in life if you keep God's commandments. Want to know if you should keep God's commandments or not? He is Yahweh. Is that persuasive enough? If not, then you don't understand that phrase. I am Yahweh, God says. I am the God who made a covenant with you. I'm the one who made a relationship with you so that you can live. So don't do the very things that make you break that relationship. Because I am the true God. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for instructions like this. They're very detailed and cover all kinds of nuances. And the reason for that, we understand, is because the people did not actually fear you and obey you. And so you spelt it out to accommodate their weakness, and they're full of excuses and saying, well, if I can't do it with the daughter of this person, can I maybe do it with the daughter of that person? You spelt it all out for them. And then, Father, you made us realize just how bad false worship, a false view of life and sacrifice and sexual morality really is. So, Father, help us, as Acts chapter 15 even reminds us all over again, to abstain from food sacrificed to idols, to abstain from eating blood and everything related to that, but to have a biblical view of the life of an animal and the blood of that animal. And Father, help us very clearly to understand the connection between sexual morality that gets eventually so perverted that it is entirely defined by false worship of the worst kind. Keep us from sin. May we fight it at every stage and kill it. Father, restore to us a high view of you and your commandments and your statutes and your laws. For if we do them, we will live by them because you are our God. We praise you in the name of Jesus Christ, our priest. Amen.